Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
It started with a headache. That was day one for Brian. And so I'm going to tell his story. I forgot, I need to start with a disclaimer. So this patient, this is his real name. The pictures are real. The imaging is real. I have permission to share this, written and verbal. So I have to say that for HIPAA compliance. But this is a real patient story, real name and everything. And this is Brian and his daughter. But it started with a headache. He was a healthy man in his 40s. And he wasn't unaccustomed to headaches. So he thought it was a warm September day. He thought, well, maybe I'm dehydrated. So he started to drink some water, but the headache persisted. He said, okay, well, maybe it's a sinus infection. I've had those before and often get a headache. So I'll just give it some time. So the next morning, day number two, he woke up and the headache was throbbing. It was much worse than it had been the day prior. So he said, okay, well, I'm going to make it through these meetings today, and then maybe after, if this gets worse, I'll go to urgent care and ask for some antibiotics. So he ended up getting through the day, very difficult, felt this kind of general sense of malaise, but got through the day, and he asked for antibiotics at the urgent care. They gave him antibiotics. He started taking it right away. This was on a Friday, again, day number two. He promised to take his son on, as he had a cross-country meet in Boone, North Carolina. This was from Greenville, South Carolina. So he drove from Greenville, South Carolina to Boone. The whole drive there, he continued to have a throbbing headache. He usually is very kind of talkative, but just felt terrible, so couldn't talk. Felt like he had a mild fever. So he ends up getting to Boone. He arrives at the hotel, immediately falls asleep, thinks, okay, I'll feel better in the morning. He wakes up in the morning, it's day number three. He actually feels much worse now. His body feels really heavy, like the effects of gravity have changed. He says, okay, I'll take a hot shower, and maybe I'll feel better after a hot shower. So he does that. He goes down to the hotel lobby, and he's sitting in the lobby in a chair just like this, but he can't get up. His body is just too heavy. So he asks his son to get him something from the breakfast bar, and he starts eating it, hoping that he'll get some energy. The antibiotics will start kicking in, but they don't. He's able to kind of will himself to a standing position, get in his car, and drive to the cross-country meet. He's at the cross-country meet, but he can no longer stand. So he just lies down in the grass and tries to like kind of pick up his head a little bit so that he can see his son running. And people, he's a guy that has a lot of energy. So people are saying, you know, Brian, what's wrong with you? What are you doing? Can I get you some water? But he's having just difficulty moving. So finally, the cross-country meet ends. He promises that he was going to meet his nephew, who's a student at App State, for lunch. The nephew noticed that during lunch, he was a little bit confused, like he was getting the names of family members wrong. He said, there's something not quite right. He finishes lunch with his nephew, and he starts driving home. So as he's driving, he's realizing he's a little bit distorted. So do I go right here or do I go left here? What's the speed limit? How fast am I driving? So he's kind of confused and says, I'm going to actually stop at McDonald's and just maybe my blood sugar's low, which has never been a problem with him before. So he gets a milkshake, vanilla milkshake, and he says that it tastes metallic. He thought maybe someone tampered with the milkshake. He doesn't remember the rest of the day. That's day number three. Day number four, he wakes up, it's Saturday. He doesn't really remember Saturday very much. Sunday, so now we're on day number five. He's watching football, and he's having some involuntary movements of his right upper extremity. His right upper extremity draws upward, and he has some jerking movements. He's conscious during this, and his kids notice it. He has three kids, and they say, Dad, what are you doing? He says, oh, I'm just stretching. He just plays it off. This continues every few minutes. And then his wife gets home from the grocery store with one of their daughters, and they start to make some hamburgers. But he fashions his hamburger in an odd way. So he doesn't have a bun on it, like the lettuce is on the bottom. Like, it doesn't make any sense. So he starts eating it, and his right arm starts going again, and then it spreads throughout his body, and he loses consciousness. He has what's called a focal to bilateral tonic-clonic seizure. So he has a kind of full-blown seizure like you'd see in the movies. So they call 911, an ambulance arrives and brings him to the hospital. When he gets to the hospital, he goes to the emergency department. They do the right thing. He has a fever. They do a lumbar puncture, testing for various infections. And then they admit him to the hospital. That's day number 5. They started him, I think, on anti-seizure medicines, specifically a medicine called Keppra or levetiracetam. It's day number 6. Brian and I meet. So I come to the hospital in the morning, and I realize that there is waiting for me a stat EEG. So an EEG is an electroencephalogram, which measures the electrical activity of the brain. So I read these commonly, and it looks like this. So I open it up, and I start looking at it, and I start to see that there's some rhythmic activity. I know that no one here reads EEGs and all, like, does anyone here read EEGs? That'd be surprising, but that would be great. So he's having some sharply contoured waveforms in the what we call the anterior leads of the brain. And this is consistent with what we call an electrographic seizure. So he's having seizures. So this EEG is 30 minutes long. It was done the night prior. And in those 30 minutes, there are 4 seizures. So I say, yikes, this isn't good. So immediately, I then go onto our system, and I open up his MRI. And I look at his MRI, and I notice that there are some major abnormalities on his MRI. So in his medial frontal lobe, there's this bright area right here. This is an area of inflammation in his frontal lobe on the left side. On MRI, left is right, right is left. But there's some inflammation here, T2 hyperintensity in the frontal lobe. I suspect these are where the seizures are coming from. There's some other T2 hyperintensity, so you see there's one right here as well. So these are areas of inflammation. I scroll through the MRI, and I see more and more of these T2 hyperintensities. So I have medical students with me all the time, and so I start asking them, you know, what do you think this is? And they say, well, Dr. LaPenna, I think that this is an infection. Okay, that's possible. So like herpes simplex virus likes to go to the frontal lobe and temporal lobes. However, it's a bit unusual for that. So at this time, I realize that Brian is actually at another hospital. So he's down the street, like 15 miles away at our sister hospital. So I immediately sign on to see him via telemedicine. And I start talking to him. And he has this kind of vacant expression. He's extremely slow to respond. His thinking is slow. We call that bradyphrenia. So he's very slow to respond. I only remember him saying one thing, and it was the last thing I heard him say for a while. But he just said, "You look too young." And I was like, all right. This was like 6 years ago. So, you know, and I was 6 months out of residency at that point. So he was right. He was right. I was too young. So I transfer him to our hospital. And I get to the bedside when he gets here. This is day number 7. He actually didn't come to the hospital until the following day because we needed to wait for an ICU bed to open. So I loaded him up with anti-seizure medicines. I loaded him up with antivirals just in case to cover him. And he came to the hospital. So I saw him on day number 7 since his headache started. And I examined him at the foot of the bed. Again, he was very slow to respond. He doesn't remember anything. The last thing he remembers is being transferred in the ambulance from one hospital to the next. That's his last memory. So other than that, he knows nothing. So we hook him up to the EEG, and now he's on continuous EEG monitoring, where we just keep it on there, and we're able to watch his brain waves continuously. So I say, Brian, his eyes were closed. Open your eyes. He slowly, slowly, slowly opened his eyes. Where are you? At the hospital. Trails off. So he's having this kind of continuous seizure activity. So I look at his right leg. His right leg is just continuously convulsing. Sometimes it corresponds to the EEG and sometimes it doesn't, but it never stops. We call that epilepsia partialis continua. So he has this continuous seizure activity in his right lower extremity. At this point, I have him on two anti-seizure medicines at maximum dose. Doesn't do anything. He continues to have these seizures. And occasionally when he's talking to me, he completely stops talking and just stares off. And on the EEG, we see an electrographic seizure corresponding to that. So he's in what we call status epilepticus. So that's ongoing seizure activity. So what we start to do here is once we realize that someone's in status epilepticus, time is brain, and we start treating very aggressively. The longer someone's seizing, the more brain damage there is. So he's on two anti-seizure medicines. We decide to intubate and to start him on general anesthetics. So I start him on propofol at max dose. Seizures don't go away. I then start him on a second general anesthetic, midazolam. Seizures continue. This goes on. I try to put him in a medically induced coma, but he continues to have seizures. I then have him on six anti-seizure medications, two general anesthetics. I've started steroids, I've repeated a lumbar puncture, and I assume that this is his immune system attacking his brain, which means there's antibodies that are attacking his brain. And to make that stop, I need to remove those antibodies. So I do what's called plasmapheresis, which is a machine you're attached to, like dialysis. It takes your plasma out, cleans it, takes the bad proteins out, puts clean plasma back in, takes 10 days. So we start this process. Despite all of these anti-seizure medicines, he's having 12 seizures an hour. There's nothing I can do to stop them. So I'm new to this hospital. I'm one of our first neurologists, and I say, get me the pentobarb. And they said, sir, we don't have that. It's a community hospital. Neurology's new. I said, well, you need to get it. The hospital I work at is wonderful, and they got it for me within a couple hours from a neighbor hospital. Pentobarbital is a sure thing. It shuts off the brain. You can think of a computer. If your computer is malfunctioning, turn it off and turn it back on again. That's pentobarb. So the idea with pentobarbital is we want to get burst suppression pattern. So I want to load him with pentobarbital. And what we want is we want the EEG to go flat for like several seconds and then get a little bit of cerebral activity so that we can see what the brain is doing and then go flat again to decrease the metabolism of the brain to stop the seizure and stop the damage. So I load him with pentobarbital. I've never seen pentobarbital fail before. Load him, goes flat. And I'm like, sweet, seizure. Oh. So then I hit him a second time, max dose, last chance, and it goes completely flat. He doesn't have a single brainwave for 10 days. So I determine brain death as part of my job. That would be consistent with brain death. There's no electrical activity in the brain that can be detected by EEG. That's my goal. I don't want to see any activity in his brain. So I want complete rest for his neurons to recover and for the plasmapheresis to start working, which takes 10 days. So he's in a pentobarb coma. The hospital's gracious. They were able to do that for me. However, several complications happen. I have him on so many medicines that he starts getting issues. He goes into renal failure. So that's a huge issue. His kidneys start shutting down. In addition to that, his heart starts slowing from the medications. It decreases the metabolism of many of our cells, including the cardiomyocytes. So the heart starts to diminish in its function. So he needs a temporary pacemaker. So he has multi-organ failure. Meanwhile, I'm barely sleeping. So I work 84 hours a week. I spent 60 hours just on him during that week, trying to help him. He had what's called new onset refractory status epilepticus, NORS, which is typically caused by what we call autoimmune encephalitis, in which the immune system attacks the brain. I spoke with his wife, his three children. They were in the waiting room all the time, giving them updates. This went on for about a month that he was in a coma. Every time what you do, you get him in the state every 48 hours, you try to lift them out. And every time I tried to lift him out of the coma, he went back into status epilepticus. So I just kept trying it, and it just wasn't working. So it started to be suggested to me, we should move to comfort measures. This person is not going to survive. But I knew in my bones that this man was going to survive. And no one could tell me otherwise, and people thought I was crazy. They weren't used to neurologists, but I had done this before, and I knew what I was doing. And I said, you need to give me time. I'm going to help this man. All right. This is Brian. So this is him in a coma. So I want to talk a little bit about getting to know Brian, or just getting to know patients in general, and then we'll return to his story. So patients, when they're hospitalized, I only work in the hospital, I do neurological emergencies. When they're hospitalized, I round on them every day that they're there. So sometimes they're there for a week, sometimes a few days, sometimes longer, sometimes a month. So I get to know these people very well. Because Brian was in a coma, of course, I got to know him through his family. So I spoke with his wife all the time. She was at the bedside a lot. So I got to know his family, his parents. He is only 40, so I got to know like his brothers and sisters and the whole family. So I get to interact with people frequently. I have patients who are artists and physicists and chemical engineers and people in recovery from substance use disorder, people from all parts of the world, people who are blue collar, white collar, you know, just a diversity of people. And when I get to know people, I learn about their various abilities. They're really good at planning. They're very creative. They're excellent with numbers. And I learn how they exercise these abilities or powers in their daily life and their job and raising their kids. I learn about their habits, their personality. And like, I really actually enjoy this part of being a doctor. Most doctors don't. Okay? But I actually really enjoy this. I like getting to know my patients. So when we talk about the psychology of a human person, we talk about what are called powers or abilities, capacities. So a power is a stable capacity of a person to carry out certain kinds of acts. So examples would be, I have the power to perceive, remember, think, and choose. I have these powers even if I'm not exercising these powers. Then we have acts or operations. So this is the exercise of a power. So for example, I have the power of memory. It may be not in use at the moment, but then you may ask me, what did you eat for breakfast? Now it's in use, it's being acted upon. And I would say, I went to Tompkins Bagels, something like that, and it was delicious. And then there are states. So states is a condition in which a person exercises their powers and performs acts. So being alert. So right now I'm alert. I'm calm. But one could be anxious. One could be joyful. Those are the states that you're in. So you could think about it this way. If you think about a pianist, the pianist has the capacity to play the piano. And she has that capacity even if she's not currently playing the piano. However, once she starts playing the piano, now that power is an act. And if she's calm and relaxed, that shapes or characterizes this act. So she plays beautifully if she's calm and relaxed, where if she's anxious, she may make mistakes. So powers, acts, and states. And I promise this will have a purpose. All right. So how we know a person? Well, we see their powers in action, perceiving, remember, and choosing. And then repeated acts form habits. That's what I talked about the last time I was here, the formation of habits through what we do. And then we do them with a certain state or disposition, cheerfully. We do them exhausted. It kind of colors our actions. And together, these things help form what we call personality. We can say things like, Brian is a hardworking and cheerful man who loves God. We can know that through these actions. So you can think about it a medical student. I teach medical students a lot, and they have various powers. They can reason and they can will. But let's say I have a student and they're struggling on their neurology rotation. Like, the neurological examination is very complex. The terminology can be very foreign. And the patients are very sick, like Brian. And it may be very overwhelming to a student to come and rotate with me. They may say, like, what is going on? Like in the case of Brian, how could I possibly help with this? This is overwhelming. But let's say that she's, this student, she's really struggling on her rotation. She's not doing well. Okay, well, she can act on her ability to reason and ability to will. So she can put reasoning into action through studying what she saw that day in order to strengthen her conceptual knowledge. She can, from exercising her will, for example, she can choose to come back every day. She can choose to present a patient when another medical student could, so that she can get better at that. She can review cases. She can present cases. All of this is very difficult, but the repeated acts forms a habit of fortitude. She overcomes this difficulty. She becomes someone who has fortitude. So at the end of her rotation, I actually see a change in her personality. She's calm, she's smiling more, she's unflustered. So these are kind of what we're talking about. So powers, acts, and states. But what I want to ask is, all of these things, kind of in modern language, we'd call them attributes. These are attributes of a person. But what happens when someone's attributes disappear? So say, for example, Brian. He can no longer act on his powers. He can't speak. He's not even conscious anymore. His powers, his attributes, they're hidden. He can't perceive. He has no memory. He has no speech. So is this still Brian? Can we reasonably say that this person who's in a coma is still Brian? Has he somehow disappeared? Or does his identity actually continue to remain? So many of you can experience this. So some of you have family members, cousins, things like that, friends who have succumbed to addictions, drug addictions, and their personality changes. Is this still the same person? Their attributes are coming and going. They seem very different. Is this still the same person? Say your grandmother, grandfather develops Alzheimer's disease. They can no longer remember things. Is this still the same person? So we see this all the time, and very frequently as a doctor, I will have maybe a wife come out whose husband is very ill or doing something very strange. Maybe they have frontal temporal dementia and say, this is not my husband. This is not the man I married. Fix him. Okay, you know? This is something I hear on a frequent basis. Sometimes this happens slowly over time, but sometimes in a case like Brian, this happens very suddenly. So that's the question we're asking. Has Brian disappeared? So the thing with attributes is that they come and go. So I have three children. I have a 10-year-old girl, I have an 8-year-old girl, and I have an 11-month-old girl. And I've watched them grow up. They're at times, they're rolling over, then they're crawling. Then they're pulling themselves to a stand, and then they're babbling, and then they're walking, and you start to see these attributes come and go. They have no hair, but now they have lots of hair. They're not speaking back to you, but now they're speaking back to you. So you start to see all of these attributes coming and going. But we assume that that's the same person through these changes. So with my 10-year-old girl, when I look back at baby pictures, she has very different attributes now than she had as a baby. But I say, Catherine, look at these pictures of you. You were so cute as a baby. But we recognize this as the same person persisting through time. Okay. So this is kind of earlier in life. And then later in life, well, our sight starts to diminish. Our hearing starts to diminish. Our mobility starts to change. We start losing certain capacities, but we also may start growing in certain areas. We may become more wise, more patient, more virtuous. We may succumb to passions less. So things come and go. Our attributes change. We grow, we age, we forget, we learn. But we remain the same person through all of it. Something endures underneath all these changes. And that's what we call a person. So this is the common sense view of personal identity. So everyone assumes that Brian still exists. No one actually thinks that Brian existed prior to his hospitalization, while he's in a comatose state and can't exercise his powers, that he no longer exists, but then may come to exist again. No one believes that. No one thinks that he was a person because he had X, Y, and Z characteristics, and now he's no longer a person because he can't exercise his intellect and will, but then if I can fix him, then he's a person again. No one actually thinks this. His doctors don't think this. His nurses don't think this. His family doesn't think this. This is the common sense view. This is the view that someone like Thomas Aquinas would hold. So we know he's not reducible to his attributes alone. And this shapes our ethics. For us to continue to care for Brian, he needs to still be Brian. If he's just kind of a hump or like a clump of matter, that changes how we treat a person. So there's ethical implications to this. Not everyone has held this view through time. So for example, John Locke thought that our personal identity was held in our memories. So that's what someone is. Their memories through time. What persists through time is memory. But memories presuppose a subject who remembers, right? You never run into memory on the sidewalk. You've never run into a memory. You run into a person in whom a memory inheres, right? Memories aren't things out there on their own. Some people think it's in a materialist description of some cognitive capacity that we have. But our brains are constantly changing. I talked about that again the last time I was here. They're always changing. Neuroplasticity is always occurring. When you leave this room, you wouldn't be the same person when you entered. And this also isn't a good view, and it also has ethical implications, especially for someone like Brian. So the question is, where is Brian? Well, he's right here. He's in a coma, right? So it's Brian that we care for. It's Brian that I work for without ceasing. It's Brian that his family is waiting for at bedside. It's Brian his nurses tend to with compassion. And it's Brian who we hope for and pray for on a regular basis. So Brian's attributes, they come and they go. But Brian is that which remains, that which grounds or stands under his changing attributes. So just to give a summary of where we are, this is going to go deeper and deeper and deeper until we understand what a human person is. So powers, acts, and states are attributes, ways a human person is or can be. And these attributes exist in a subject, the individual person who stands under them and remains the same throughout. So we have a human person, a substance. Substance just means to stand under. And we have attributes. The attributes inhere in a substance. They come, they go, they fall off, but they inhere in a subject who remains through time. So we need to go deeper, though. So we need to actually talk about what is the person, what is a human person who grounds these attributes? So this is the question, in some sense, that the psalmist is asking. What is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? From Psalm 8:4. So in other words, what is the fundamental nature of the human person? So that's what we're after. Okay. So one thing to notice here is to kind of, as Aquinas does, to argue against this position. So when we look at Brian, what we see is, and neurologists, we see this all the time, that brain damage equals mind damage. So when Brian's brain is damaged from antibodies attacking it, his mind is damaged. His ability to reason diminishes, speaking diminishes, control of his body diminishes, his ability to recall information diminishes. So when the brain is attacked, the mind is attacked. What happens to the brain happens to the mind. If Brian's brain dies, his mind dies. and legally the person dies. So it's very easy for a neurologist to reduce the person to their brain and just say, the person is really nothing but their brain. If Brian recovers, his mind recovers. So it seems like the mind and brain are really just the same thing. So that would be the kind of argument from a materialist or a physicalist. But it's important to note that for two things to be identical, so in the north, I'm from the Boston area, we call traffic circles, we call them rotaries. I don't know what you guys call them around here, if you have them. But where I'm from now in the south, we call them roundabouts. Okay, maybe you call them roundabouts, seems. All right, I don't know what we're doing in the Boston area. So, and then, so rotaries, roundabouts, and traffic circles, right? Those are three words for the same thing. Okay, that's what it means for something to be identical. These are not actually different things. They're just three names that we assign to one thing, like the morning star and the evening star and Venus. They're all the same thing. Okay, I think, right? You can double check me on that. All right, so for two things to be identical, they need to share all the same properties. Okay, so if our psychological phenomena, our mental states, have different properties than our brain states, then they can't be the same thing. So that's what I want to look at. Okay, so let's see, I'm gonna pick on somebody. Let's see, Jan, where's Jan? Jan, all right, great. All right, so let's say, Jan, do you have a significant other? Not at the moment. Ladies, Jan is single and very handsome man. I didn't ask him to do that. He didn't, but I'm doing it anyways. So let's say that Jan's leaving here tonight and he meets a lovely young woman, and it's love at first sight. And he's there. But I just spoke at NYU last night, and they're looking to do some, this is made up, NYU, don't sue me. They're looking to do some research on romantic love. NYU, the professors there, they've never understood romantic love. So it's escaped them. And they really want to look into this further. So they say, Jan, we've heard about this guy, Jan, and he's deeply in love with some young lady. So they say, let's do a functional MRI on Jan. And let's have him look at a picture of this woman that he loves. And they say, let's see what areas of the brain light up. So they stick him in there, he looks at the picture, and they say, are you feeling romantic? Do you feel like you're in a state of love? He says, oh, yes, very much, sir. So they start taking the pictures, and they see what lights up, and all sorts of areas, the anterior cingulate gyrus and the putamen and the caudate nucleus, and all these things start lighting up, and they're like, wow, look at that depolarization. This is amazing. So they see it, they map out love, and they know it now. This is romantic love. It's on the scan. All right. So he comes out of the functional MRI, and they're like, hey, there's a second part to this study. And they give you a lecture on neuroplasticity, and they're like, don't worry, what we're going to do, it's all going to work out in the end. We're actually going to excise, we're going to cut out all those parts of the brain on the functional MRI so we can study it a little bit more because we're desperate. So they cut that area out. You say yes. They convince you that it's all going to come back again. So anyways, they cut it out. And this young lady who you met, she comes to check on you in post-op, and she realizes, Jan doesn't seem like he really loves me anymore. And the scientist says, oh, no, wait a second. And he has this box, a tray with him that has Jan's cortex in it. And he says, here's Jan's love for you. Would that actually be romantic love? Of course it would not be, right? Of course it would not be. I almost said that it is. This is from being a neurologist. It is not. Well, why isn't it? Well, because the psychological phenomena of being in love is not the same as the brain state that's necessary for you to be in love. They're two different things, right? One, it may be necessary, but it's not sufficient, right? You need that neural tissue, but it doesn't mean it's sufficient. It's not identical to. Well, why isn't it identical to? Well, you have certain properties of neural tissue. There's mass and volume and shape, and they conduct electrical chemical signals. But that's not what love is. Love is to will the good of the other. It's a personal act, an intentional state directed towards another person. Neural tissue, on the other hand, is a necessary condition for Jan to be in love, but that doesn't imply that it's identical to love. My neurons no more will the good of another as a pile of rocks do. They don't will anything at all, right? So psychological phenomena are intentional. Our neurons are not. So they're not identical. Well, you can keep going. Let's say that I pick one of you. You have tremendous pain. You come to see me in the office. I don't work in the office. I work in the hospital. But let's say you come and see me anyways, and you say, I'm having this terrible pain. And I say, describe to me this pain. But I didn't know that you're actually a neuroscientist. So instead of saying things like, it's throbbing, it's sharp, it's burning, it's excruciating, you start by saying, well, C fibers are activated in my skin, which then send signals to the dorsal root ganglion. And then from there, the spinal thalamic tract sends electrical chemical signals to the VPL nucleus of the thalamus, and then that goes to the postcentral gyrus. And I'd be like, excuse me? I know what you just said, but you're not actually describing being in a state of pain. You're describing the pathway associated with being in pain, right? So pain is described qualitatively. Neural tissue is described quantitatively. You're in the wrong category. So our psychological phenomena are qualitative. Our neural tissue is described, at least in the mechanical kind of worldview, it's described quantitatively. So qualitative versus quantitative. So another difference. Another thing is that your spinal thalamic tract cannot be in pain, right? It's not a bearer of pain. Pain is something that's had by a person. It's subjective. It's had by a subject. It's not had by neural tissue. Neural tissue cannot be in pain. It cannot suffer. Only a human being can, right? Is it necessary? Yes. Is it identical? No. So there's a distinction. Our mental states also have normative properties. So the normative means it belongs to the realm of rules, standards, correctedness. So it carries things like what we ought to do, what's true and what's false, what's right and wrong, and valid and invalid. So again, I'm from the Boston area. If I say the proposition, the Red Sox won the World Series in 2004, that's either true or it's false, right? But no cluster of neurons is true or false. They just fire. So that's like asking if sodium channels are correct or incorrect. It doesn't make any sense. So how about a logical inference? All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. That's valid or invalid. But the firing pattern in my prefrontal cortex that's associated with that is not valid or invalid. So the moral of this is that I have intentional, qualitative, subjective, and normative properties, and matter does not have any of these properties. Therefore, I cannot be purely material. Well, then, can a person be fully immaterial? This seems to be somewhat of a popular view. So if we think about something like Cartesian dualism, which is popular, even if people don't know what that is, the real person is the inner self. The real person is the soul. So Descartes thought that we were two different substances, but really we're just one of those two substances. So you have an immaterial mind, a soul. So for him, the soul is the mind. So you have this immaterial mind, this is this one substance, and then you have this other substance, which is the body, which is something external to you, like trees and rocks. You inhabit this thing, right? But it's not you. So you can like see this a lot in our culture. So there's many problems with this. I won't go through them all. But say I want to move my right arm. Well, I know neurologically that in the contralateral hemisphere, in the precentral gyrus, in the fifth layer of the neocortex, there's Bett cells. and they send signals that go all the way to my arm so I can move my arm. This happens through action potentials in my neurons. But how is it that an immaterial soul would cause that? How is something non-spatial interacting through a mechanism or efficient causality, a mechanism to cause my arm to move? That would be very difficult to explain. It kind of reduces the body to a vessel as well. I really feel this way, but my body is different than how I feel. Therefore, I need to manipulate my body in a way that matches my psychological state. But this view is incoherent. So we need a way forward. And that's where we get into the Catholic idea of the human person. But the person, so far, is not purely material. Matter alone can't explain our higher powers. A person is not purely immaterial. The mental life depends upon the body. We are embodied. We need a view that accounts for both dimensions, a view that does justice to the body and mind together. So enter Aquinas and hylomorphism. So just to catch you guys up so I don't lose anyone, hopefully you're still with me. We have powers, acts, and states. These are attributes. They inhere in a subject, a substance, a person. They come and go, but that which they inhere in persists through time. The person beneath these attributes, the substance, is neither purely material nor purely immaterial, but a unity of both. Okay. So when we start to talk about hylomorphism, or this kind of idea from Aristotle, probably the most effective way to communicate this is through what we call the four causes. I think it's fairly intuitive. But so if you describe something simple, say, for example, a table. Say someone doesn't know what a table is. That would be weird. But you want to describe to them what a table is. You'd give the material cause, what it's made out of. It's made out of wood. You'd give the efficient cause, what brought it about. You would say, a carpenter, their tools, some nails, some glue, that's what brought it about. And you'd say, okay, but you could make many things out of wood. A carpenter could do that, but it still doesn't tell me what it is. So you'd want to give the formal cause, the shape, the contour, the organization of it. It's rectangular. It has four legs. Okay, you start to get a picture of it, but then the last thing to fully understand it would be, what's the purpose of the thing? What's it for? Well, it's for putting things on. It could be notes, it could be food, you could be studying at it, whatever it may be. For me, it's usually a child. It's always a child on our dinner table, like on it. Get off. All right, so you could give this, every single object and every act can kind of be explained through the four causes. So if you think about the heart, for example, so what's the material cause of the heart? Cardiomyocytes, made out of cardiomyocytes. What's the efficient cause? Well, certain embryonic cell lines, instead of becoming neurons, became cardiomyocytes. Okay, what's the formal cause? Well, there's four chambers, there's four valves. What's the purpose? It pumps blood. Speech. So right now I'm talking to you. What's the material cause? Well, I give like a whole 60-minute lecture on that. So we can talk about like the inferior frontal gyrus on the left side. We can talk about the cortical bulbar tracts, cranial nerves, the movements of muscles in my face. That's the material cause. What's the efficient cause? Well, that's the kind of neurophysiology that occurs within there, the exchange of ions across a cell membrane and action potentials occurring in cells. Okay, what's the formal cause? Well, that's the linguistic structure of my talk, the concepts I'm talking about, the organization, this kind of linguistic architecture of how I'm speaking to you. It gives meaning, intelligibility, it gives a shape and form. The talk has kind of this shape, form to it, hopefully. Okay, so then you talk about the purpose. What's the purpose of it? Well, it's to talk about what a human person is. So you can see how these four causes explain things. So then what we want to kind of say is, okay, well, how does this relate to a human person, what we are? So from this, all of these four causes are necessary to explain the human person, but I'm just going to talk about two of these causes, which kind of contain the others. So that's matter and form. Matter and form come together to cause a substance. So a substance is made out of matter and form. A substance is the basic kind of unit of things. So we often think that matter is something determinate. So like a water bottle or a table or something like that. So we use like molecular model kits in chemistry class, and we think of these determinate things. This is the 100th anniversary of quantum mechanics, though, and quantum mechanics shows that that's actually not the case, that the fundamental aspect of matter is that it's indeterminate. It's neither here nor there, neither this nor that until acted upon. So you can think about it simply as like if you imagine a cupboard full of different types of food. So from that, there's the potential from all of those different ingredients where you could make all sorts of different meals. Okay, so if you imagine flour, with flour you could make cake, muffins, you could thicken a stew, you could make a pie crust. Okay, the flour is indeterminate, right? It can become many different things. And that's when we think about like particles at their most basic level, it's that which has potentiality to become many different things. Werner Heisenberg, for example, who won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of quantum mechanics, among others, explicitly used the concept of potentiality from Aristotle to actually explain these things. So he really says we need to understand Aristotle's idea of potentials that matter at its basic core is potentiality. It can become this or that. It's malleable. But how does it actually become something? It needs to be acted upon. So in quantum mechanics, there's wave functions. When you observe an experiment, the wave function collapses, and then like an electron will take an actual position. It's very odd, but it has no position prior to that. It's neither here nor there, which is really weird. But then when you observe it, it takes a position. If there's an interaction or something, so you have something that actualizes the potential. Okay, that's what we call form. So you have matter, which is potential, and you have form, which actualizes it. It's that which makes a thing become that which is intended to be. So matter and form. So Aristotle believed that that's kind of what makes us who we are. Just very briefly, when we talk about the qualitative aspects of things, so in the scientific revolution, there was this kind of Aristotle Aquinas would say something like, if you think of an apple, the apple is red and it's sweet, like the apple is that. In the scientific revolution, what occurred was anything that couldn't be described mathematically got removed from the definition of matter. So an example would, so what you would say is like, the redness of the apple, the sweetness of the apple is not actually in the apple. It's in the perceiver, right? So this is not what Aristotle and Aquinas would think. They would think that the apple is sweet and the apple is red, and you perceive it correctly, that the sweetness and redness of the apple is in the apple and it's in you as well. You perceive it for what it is. That our senses are correctly proportioned to reality as it actually is. And to me, that seems completely necessary for science to work. If we don't actually perceive the world as it is, I don't really know what science is at that point. So that's form. And so the idea is these things actually have a form which gives them qualities that have been abstracted away during the scientific revolution. And then there's intentionality. So that these things in nature actually have a purpose. It's not just us projecting a purpose on the thing. So there's a time where people didn't know what the heart, you know, does, that they didn't know it was something that pumped blood. But the heart is that which pumps blood, even if you don't think it is. That's what it is. The thing itself has a purpose. So the objects of nature are much more metaphysically robust than we think they are. They have real forms, they have real qualities, and they have a real purpose. So nature is just much more rich than modern science gives it credit for. So when we get to the human person, we're not unlike other things within nature. So everything in nature is a composite of form and matter. A human being is also a composite of form and matter. So we have qualities and we have intentionality, just like everything else does. So not all forms, though, are equal. So different things receive different forms. So that's why things are different. So you have some things, some entities, physical entities out there that have the capacity for things like growth, reproduction, taking in nutrients. That would be plants. If we think about animals, further capacities are added to animals, such as sensing, perceiving, locomotion, desiring, memory. Animals are wonderful. And that's because the form they received. Human beings, you add further to that, that we have two very unique things. We have intellect and we have will, because we have a particular type of form. So during this lecture, for example, I tell you about, you know, all these different concepts, personal identity, materialism, hylomorphism, and I express this through language. When I prepare for this lecture, I deliberate on what I want to include and what I should omit. These are acts of the intellect and will. You all who are listening are able to understand what's being said, hopefully, and you're able to deliberate upon those things. You can accept them or reject them, but realize this is very unique to humans. For example, like if there was a dolphin in here, I mean, it would be problems because it's not in the water, but it wouldn't understand this lecture. Not because dolphins aren't awesome, not because they don't have memory and perception and things, but they don't have intellect and will as we define it for humans. So they're wonderful creatures, but, you know, a dolphin can't become Catholic, for example, right? It requires intellect and will. So this form that we've received is called the rational soul. So that's what we're referring to. So an example would be about the rational soul. So if my wife, for example, gave me a grocery list, which she often does, she'll give me a grocery list to go like get things for her, and I often mess it up. But let's say that it said on the list, flowers, eggs, propositions, bacon, justice, apples, and three facts, right? I'm gonna really struggle to get some of the things on that list. Propositions, justice, and facts, right? And I often do mess up and bring the wrong things home, but she ought not to get mad at me for that, because those are not material things. Those are not things that I can actually go and get, right? They're immaterial. They're not material objects. So Aquinas and, you know, argues, and the Catholic tradition argues, that that which comprehends the immaterial itself must also be immaterial. And that's what the intellect and the will are. They're immaterial. And because they have an operation through themselves, they're not reliant upon the body because they're immaterial. They survive the death of the body. They're subsistent. Okay, so the soul of a human being, unlike plants and animals and things, survives the death of the body. More so, I'll kind of skip that, but more so, the what it means to be created in the image of God is that God has intellect and will, and He graciously has bestowed that upon us, that we too have intellect and will, and we can exercise that. And that's what it means to be created in the image of God. Okay. I relate this back to God, but so that I don't run out of time, and I can kind of talk about those things in the Q&A, I'll just give a summary of where we are so far, and then we'll get back to Brian. So we have attributes. Our attributes, they come and they go, but they inhere in a substance who remains through those changes, the person. A person is a composite of form and matter. soul and body, act and potentiality. The form of a human person is what we call a rational soul. And that is what it means to be made in the image of God. And God, in his divine ideas, so we hear, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. That form, that soul, comes from God and is bestowed upon us. It is given to us as a gift, and it sets us apart from the rest of creation. Okay, let's get back to Brian. Okay. So, I'm just going to kind of finish off his story. I've been writing a book for a few years, and this is just a little section I wrote on this. The book will probably never be published because I just can never finish anything due to work doing things for the TI and any spare time I have. just kidding, but kind of. All right. I examined Brian one day. We were backing down on his pentobarbital. I asked him to open his eyes, follow commands, anything. There was no sign of life, so to speak. I left somewhat discouraged. Perhaps everyone was right. I briefly thought, shook it off. I was descending the stairs from the ICU with my nurse practitioner when I suddenly stopped. Go back. A second time. Go back. It was an internal prompting, an oceanic tug, not something audible, nor something biological. I turned to Jessica. I have to go back. I began to walk up the stairs. It was I who was walking, yet I was being led, tugged, and I could not do otherwise. Yet, it was the pinnacle of freedom. The line separating God's providence and my freedom was no longer distinct, for we moved as one. I walked up to Brian. He lay there, motionless, the tubing from the ventilator now running through his neck into his trachea. I leaned in, my mouth inches from his ear. Brian, open your eyes. I waited a moment, nothing more. I wasn't going to say it again. Then a gentle furrow of his brow, the barest sliver of his eyes parting, like a door cracking open just enough to let a shimmer of light escape. First, the whites of his eyes, then color, until finally Brian's eyes were open, fully open, looking at me. He was alive. My heart surged into my throat, my eyes blurring with tears. Someone get Brian's wife on the phone. Brian had opened his eyes. He was staring at me. I could see that the stare was not vacant. His eyes reflected thoughts. What would it be like to wake up after a month of being in a coma? The distant sounds of beeps and the clamor of voices in the ICU would draw near. The sterile aroma of disinfectants, the feel of a tube inserted into your trachea with air being pushed into your lungs. You begin to consciously attend to your arms, flexing and extending your fingers. They feel heavy, weak, and stiff. You begin to fix your attention to your legs and try to wiggle your feet, but they don't move. You try again, but nothing. Fear enters your mind. Eyes are now open. You process what you see. Tubes, IVs, something inserted through your abdomen and into your stomach, nurses pressing buttons on pumps, and a doctor speaking to you. Why is he smiling? Brian, you're okay, you're okay. You have been asleep for a long time, but you're doing okay. Your wife is on her way. There is nothing more to prevent the panic. Brian would attempt to piece together the broken fragments, but there were no fragments to be found, nothing to remember. Time had slipped away from him, irretrievable now. I had devoted everything I could to Brian, every skill, every bit of knowledge, all my energy, countless hours away from my family, lost hours of sleep, every ounce of effort. And although he would still rely on me in the coming years, now it was Brian's turn to bear the brunt of the work. Yet Brian was stubborn, really stubborn. And when directed at the good, well, that's good. Brian would continue immunotherapy, specifically a medicine called rituximab, and I would gradually reduce his anti-seizure medications, eventually weaning him off of all medications. Initially, Brian couldn't walk. So here he is. Initially, Brian couldn't walk and had lost the ability to flex his feet. But with months of rehabilitation, he regained these abilities. Ultimately, Brian made a full recovery aside from the mental trauma of the experience, although he has largely overcome that as well, and is now more grateful for the gift of life than ever before. Every year on his birthday, he sends me a family picture and a heartfelt thank you, surrounded by his loved ones. 1 year after caring for Brian at the hospital, my wife and two girls, had a daughter since, sat around his dining table, joined by his three children and wife. It was a feast and celebration of life, lived to the fullest. Laughter filled the air as they shared stories of Brian painting his daughter's nails and surprising them in the morning, jumping out from hidden places. They teased each other and exchanged jokes. Love was palpable. I smiled and simply listened, feeling myself being swept above, transcending the scene in the heights of my mind. There were smiling faces, bodies shaking with laughter, and a natural flow of conversation, and a supernatural joy that could only be contained in the collective. My smile expanded, my shoulders began to shake with laughter. I too was full of joy. We got in the van, and their family stood at the entry of their home. As we began to drive, my girls waved and yelled goodbye out their windows. "Dad," began Catherine, "how do you know that man?" I thought for a moment. "He is one of my patients, and I helped him in a time of need." So I have the best job in the world. Being a neurologist is the best job, I think. But things do not always go the way that they did with Brian. Sometimes I'm at a funeral instead. Patients that die, I try to go to their funerals as well. A lot of times things are very difficult, and they don't end this way. So remember, I had a young woman, very young woman, who had a disease that she should never have at the age that she was. And she had small children at home. And she came into the hospital dying. And my job was just to try to help her get to survive through Christmas. I did the best I could. But it was a horrible disease. Couldn't swallow anymore, so she was choking on her own saliva. It was a difficult way to die. And I remember getting home and thinking, you know, she'll make it through. There's nothing I can do for her, but she'll make it through if that's what God wills. There's nothing I can do. But what can I do as a physician when the pillars of Western medicine crumble? What can I actually do? So I remember searching through a book of liturgy and finding a poem in there about the soul. So the next morning, I went to her bedside and I said, "Is it okay if I read this?" I let her husband read it beforehand. So we all stood around, had held hands, and we read the poem. And everyone was crying. And I left. She made it through Christmas and then died shortly thereafter. But a lot of times in medicine, moments like that, there are moments of joy, like his case, but there are moments of deep heartache. And sometimes I have to pull myself away and just go in a stairwell by myself and just sit there and just wait for the emotions to pass and then go on to see other patients. What I've realized, I've talked in here about our attributes changing, being here in a substance. But that substance, us as a whole, we go through changes as well. We lose people who are close to us. We lose certain capacities. We go through changes, and that's very difficult. The one thing that maybe take away from this is that everything changes but one. So we hear in the book of Malachi, "I, the Lord God, do not change." I think if I was to give a recommendation to people as a doctor, I tell people, I give recommendations, you make decisions. And it's variable what the response is. But what I would say is, to get through life, I see tragedies very frequently, but to get through life, you need to be anchored in something that does not change, and that's only God. So I'll leave you with this. This is John 15:5. "I am the vine, and you are the branches. Whoever abides in me, and I in him, He it is that bears much fruit, for apart from me, you can do nothing. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.